wisdom of
So, Doran, after this, if in a computer terminal you have not only characters, but you have images created through mathematical formulas and through digital information, is that what is that meaning with intelligence?
Oh, I think so.
So it's not even it's not only image. It's near insight.
It's the product of other people's insight.
Yeah.
The same as a text is. See, a text is not just black marks on white paper. It's the expression of acts of intelligence, judgment, and moral responsibility on the part of an author or a community.
But when does the question rise? Lorigan always says that there's a question before association. I sometimes don't see any
before association.
Before making the associations that give an insight.
Yeah. Well, the question arises, you know, when your reception of a text or your reception of the words that I'm speaking right now. There's some understanding that's involved there. But you still have to ask now, have I really understood what he's saying? Or have I really understood what this text is saying? And how deeply have I understood it? And so on. And the more you pursue the understanding on your own part, the more it becomes yours. It's not just the confidence or the belief that is involved in receiving what somebody else has said, but it becomes your own possession.
So it has to be, it's close to the experience of attentiveness.
Yeah.
And you know, it has to do with that, with the intensity of like intentionality. We can say there's an intensity there.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that attentiveness itself in human matters involves some meaning, so that there's a verstehen, there's a kind of understanding there. But it isn't Lonergan's insight as, oh, it's more, it's duller than that. It's not as exciting as your own. Oh, my God, you know. But you do understand to a certain extent the words that I'm speaking. But it's only through your own insight that they become yours. And that I want to differentiate the understanding with which you receive that, and the insight with which this really becomes something that is yours, that you can apply in many different ways, that you can express in different language, different terms, and so on and so on, then it's yours.
So it's not so flashy, that insight, it's more like a process.
Yeah, it's a process. It is a process.
It's more like distilling something.
Yeah. It's a process. A lot of the things that he's talking about are processes, you know, I mean, they're acts. They're acts that occur, but they inform a process. Conversion also is, for the most part, a process. Occasionally it happens, you know, but for the most part it's a process.
Okay, I'm getting it now.
See, now, so it's becoming yours. I'm getting it. That's data. But maybe we could say that's an inauthentic mini-discorder.
Yes, definitely has dialectical issues.
Yeah, dialectical. It's got dialectical problems maybe with what I'm saying. It's tuning out. Okay, I'm going to skip right over to natural right and historical mindedness, unless you have questions on the essay of the human good, because the human good, if you read chapter 2 of Method and Theology, you see he doesn't really say anything in the chapter. The recording that we have of the human good, by the way, is very, very good, because it was made by CBC. It was recorded by CBC for Radio Broadcast Ideas, their ideas program. And we are allowed to distribute the recording on CD. We can't sell it. It's their property, so we cannot sell it. But we do have, do we have any copies of it? Of Lonergan? Yeah. So if you want a complete copy of the CD, you can have it. Lonergan's lecture on the human good. All right, so natural right and historical mindedness. And I just start out by saying that I regard this as one of his most important papers. It brings together a tremendous amount of stuff from his work, as well as showing him pushing. He wrote this paper and Theology and Praxis, which we'll see next week, in a 3 or 4 month period. And I remember him saying that it was a real workout to do these two, because... And I think it was 1977, he was asked to give keynote addresses by both the American Catholic Philosophical, which is where he gave this, and the Catholic Theological Society of America, which is where he gave Theology and Praxis. So he did it. All right, so in this paper, his issue is collective responsibility. What constitutes collective responsibility? And to face that question squarely, one must answer the prior question, are there any norms at all for individual and collective responsibility once historical mindedness is admitted? So once you admit that, you know, historical mindedness, things change, new standards or institutions change, and so on and so forth, are there any standards at all for individual and collective, norms for individual and collective responsibility? In answering this question, for all intents and purposes, Lonergan identifies natural law with the transcendental precepts. He doesn't say it in so many words. He only says it in so many words once or twice in response to questions. And he also presents perhaps his most nuanced articulation of the dialectic of history. But the initial question, what is collective responsibility, is perhaps even more important, as it signals, and you're getting my interpretation here, yet a further move on Lonergan's part to the equivalent in his own thought of what for Hegel was objective spirit. What then is collective responsibility? Well, first of all, he says it's not something that currently can be regarded as an established fact, but it is a possibility that we can realize and that we should realize. So we should be able to get to the point where communities, collectivities, can exercise responsibility. This, you know, there's the whole thing of the social nature even of grace. I think I've mentioned it before. That comes out in the chapter 6 of his De Deo Trino, which will finally become available in English in the published form in another year or so, within the next year. But in the 6th chapter, the state of grace for Lonergan is a social situation. It's the three divine subjects and the community of human subjects that say yes to the offer of divine love. That's the state of grace. It's a society. It's a social. It's a community. So he's already got this thing about the, you know, he's every bit as concerned with the community as he is with the individual. And here he's coming to the collectivity and its responsibility. But he'll address it by bringing together two elements already existing in the Western tradition, namely the notion of natural right or natural law, and the recognition that besides human nature, there is human historicity. I'm going to come back in a moment in the next number 13 to the expression natural right and why he's using that expression. What we have to do, I feel, he writes, is to bring these two elements together, natural right or natural law, and human historicity. We have so to develop the notion of natural right as to make it no less relevant to human historicity than it is to human nature. If we are able to do this, we will gain at least some purchase on the constitution of collective responsibility. And if the notion of natural right or natural law is relevant to historicity, that means there is some way of articulating a normative stance, even when one admits the reality of historical mindedness. Now, the expression natural right. I am almost certain that the occasion for writing this paper is the Straussian presence at Boston College, where he was living and teaching at this time. Leo Strauss and his disciples, they figure very prominently in the intellectual atmosphere of Boston College, where Lonergan was teaching. One of Strauss's more important books is entitled Natural Right and History. It's a book that is mentioned in one of the footnotes in this article itself. Natural right was Strauss's term for what most of us call natural law. So, and Strauss's thesis, put rather simply, but not without, this is not a violation of it, is that natural law cannot be reconciled with historical consciousness. That the acceptance of historical consciousness is ipso facto a capitulation to relativism. And so Strauss is anti-modern in the sense of we must go back to the classic positions on morality expressed in Plato and Aristotle. And these are not compatible with the acceptance of historical consciousness. It seems to me to be obvious that Lonergan is addressing Strauss in this paper. The title, Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, over against the title of Strauss's book, Natural Right and History. The position that Lonergan's taking, yes, natural law, which was envisioned by the Greeks, is compatible with the recognition of historical consciousness and historical mindedness and the changes that take place and so on and so forth. We do not have to be anti-modern and anti-historical in order to avoid relativism. But the only thing that will avoid relativism is natural right or natural law understood as be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. So I think he's presenting his own response to a very prevalent intellectual atmosphere at the college where he was teaching at that time. So for Lonergan, it's not the case that the acceptance of historical consciousness is ipso facto a capitulation to relativism in the sense that there are no norms or no standards whatsoever. But the only alternative to relativism, provided one acknowledges historical consciousness, is found in the norms inherent in the transcendental unfolding of the human spirit in quest of intelligibility, truth, and the good. So, section one of the paper addresses historicity, or the awareness of historical consciousness, the historical mindedness or historical consciousness. Historicity is the variable in the concrete human reality, whereas human nature is the constant. It's the same human nature. Historicity is the term that is used for all of the changes evident in the course of the unfolding of human history. Historicity is what we make of humanity, is his language here, what man makes of man, what humans make of human destiny. We see it already in the difference between the child beginning kindergarten and the doctoral candidate writing a dissertation. But that's just the historicity of in the individual, the development that has taken place in those years. The education of individuals is a recapitulation of the longer process of the education of humankind, of the evolution of social institutions and the development of cultures. And this next sentence, I think, is very important. It expresses the significance of historicity on the cultural and social levels. Religions and art forms, languages and literatures, sciences, philosophies, the writing of history, all had their rude beginnings, slowly developed, reached their peak, perhaps went into decline, yet later underwent a renaissance in another milieu. And what is true of cultural achievements also, though less conspicuously, is true of social institutions. The family, the state, the law, the economy, are not fixed and immutable entities. They adapt to changing circumstance. They can be reconceived in the light of new ideas. They can be subjected to revolutionary change. So, historicity at the cultural and social level, and also the very fact there, what he's saying at least, is that norms do not exist at the level of cultural achievements or social institutions. That is not where we go to find norms. Right. So it's a radical statement about the changes in cultural cultures and social institutions. And I think it's why Whitson's book just on religion, The Coming Convergence of World Religions, appealed to him so predominantly. Fred Crow has said in several places in his own writings, we don't know what Christianity is going to be like, 5,000 years from now. We don't know yet what God's really got in mind with all of this stuff. It will change. There are certain things that will remain permanent. Having come thus far, we cannot come this far. And this is definitely for Lonergan and Crow, would be the achievements of the councils of Nicaea and Chalcedon and so on. That's not going to undergo. But the rest of it, it's going to be very different.
Excuse me, Bob.
Yeah.
What norms does he refer to here? Norms do not exist. What norms?
No norms exist at the level of cultural achievements and social institutions. So, no culture is normative for genuine humanity. And no state is the normative political entity. They're all subject to change. Better ideas can come along. No family arrangements. And this is quite radical in the light of a lot of the debate that's going on in this country today. No family arrangements are normative. Okay? They can be subjected to change under the force of new ideas. And history will show that. All right? How many wives did Abraham have? Yes.
I was just reading Max Scheller.
Reading what?
Max Scheller.
Yeah.
And he kind of emphasizes this is a ressentiment, and then he's speaking of how Christianity and its emphasis on the family is really an apprehension of an objective hierarchy of value.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something that is apprehended in how the family ought to be constituted that is objective,
mm-hmm.
that is normative,
mm-hmm.
For the flowering of society and mm-hmm. so on. And I was reading it, and I'm also thinking of, for instance, where he speaks of the scale of values,
mm-hmm.
and how that is kind of materialized in institutions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that related to...
Who speaks of the scale of values, Lonergan or Shaler?
Lonergan. Yeah.
Okay. Whatever normativity there is in the institution of the family is a reflection of the normativity that there is that is the unfolding of transcendental attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility, not the other way around. So that's the response that he would have to that. There may be. We're going to say, I don't think that, I have to be very careful. I'm not going to go into the specifics of it. Because but the point is that the source of any genuineness in a social institution is the attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility that gave rise to that social form. And so the social form is an embodiment of that. Okay. And you can have, it's clear that you can have families that are husband, wife, and children that are anything but reflections of attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility that are destructive. Now, that doesn't mean the institution itself is, that there's a destructiveness built into the institution, and there isn't. There's not. Not at all. You can hardly say that form itself is normative. because that statement flies in the face of the data of people being destroyed within family, dysfunctional families.
Yeah, I was going to compliment his question maybe go a little bit behind your answer. Like in Canada, we can see that there's more new types of relationships being established of people who are just having a certain type of commitment without getting married even by civil law or by confession, by religious confession, that is there. It's a huge amount of people. It's more people. There are more people in Canada just living with some type of commitment than being married legally, let's say with the state or with one of the churches. So, and you talk to persons, and there's a new way of perceiving commitment and ways of perceiving things. It will be very complex because just being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible, it's just a form. Yeah. How do you do when it's such a big problem?
I mean, on that, I'm going to come to the I'm going to be more traditional in this sense, if I could. When he speaks of the three forms of love, mm-hmm. he'll speak about domestic love and love in the civil community and the love of God. And he will be emphasizing commitment in that.
Domestic love.
Yeah. Definitely. And, his own language, that is definitely referring, he'll definitely use the language of husband and wife and children. But the big issue is, for me at least, is that floating in and out of relationships is just drifting. There comes a point where one has to say, I think. The existential moment where you realize it's up to yourself to decide for yourself what you're going to make of yourself. And that is also, there's also an existential moment in relationships where that just becomes a crucial question. That doesn't mean that there isn't a preparation for that, but it's all quite complex. It is complex. I've heard quite traditional Catholics, priests and so on, who have said that sacramental marriage should be far rarer than it is, and that there should be something else that we have in the Church of the blessing of unions. But that very few, significant, relatively few people who are sacramentally married are really ready for that. And that we may be doing a great injustice by seeing sacramental marriage as the only form under which the Church will recognize a union. And there may be some truth to that. This is pastorally not the field in which I work. I've only married relatives of mine. and even there I've had some questions, but although they're still together. But, I just wonder if there isn't some truth to that, of whether we should have a differentiated recognition of relationships and an acknowledgement and the Church's blessing. But a sacramental marriage is a terribly serious thing with terribly serious consequences for people. So anyway, it's an issue, and I don't know. I don't have an answer to it. I'm just raising a question on this. But what he's saying here is that these things do change, and certainly even in the course of what we call salvation history, we can see the change in the institution of family. Abraham, the father of faith, had at least two wives, at least two. Yeah, I don't know if there are more, but, that's not the case today in the community that came from his response of faith. Anyway, am I on target with what I'm saying? Do you understand what I'm getting at? All right, what makes for these changes? All such change is, in its essence, a change of meaning, a change of idea or concept or judgment or evaluation of the order or the request, what people are looking for, what they want, what they demand. Such changes in meaning bring with them changes in cultural achievements and social institutions. Why is this the case? Because human community is an achievement of common meaning. And that common meaning, so human community, as the first time I heard him say this, I just thought, because I heard him say, community is not a matter of people living within a given geographical frontier. That's just an assembly or something. Community is the achievement of common meaning. That's what makes for community. And so that common meaning is what informs and actuates family and polity, the legal and economic systems, customary morals and educational arrangements, as well as language, literature, art, and religion, philosophy, science, and the writing of history. Change the common meaning, and all of these dimensions of human living will change as well. Challenge the common meaning, and you are challenging the achievements of the culture and its social institutions. And the common meaning can be challenged or changed in any number of ways, at the levels of experience, or understanding, or judging, or deciding. Without a common level of experience, people get out of touch. Without a common mode of understanding, there arise misunderstanding, distrust, suspicion, fear, hostility, factions. Without a common measure of judgment, people live in different worlds. Without common consent, they operate at cross purposes. Then common meaning is replaced by different and opposed meanings. A cohesion that once seemed automatic has to be bolstered by the pressures, the threats, the force that secure a passing semblance of unity but may prepare a lasting resentment and a smoldering rebellion. It's what institutions that are in crisis always have to avoid, is moving in that direction, of moving in the direction of pressures, threats, and force that will bring about a seeming unity but that are actually just making people angrier in the long run. What has to be done is an appeal to dialogue and to the unfolding of on the communal level of intelligence, reasonableness, and responsibility. However, this does not mean every change is a good thing. Every challenge is a good thing, or that every change is a bad thing, that every challenge is a bad thing. So the issue is, how the heck do you determine what is good and what isn't at this level of constitutive meaning? Well, historical mindedness, to understand people and their institutions, we have to study their history, not just the common human nature that they all share. So he's going back now and trying to take these two issues of historical mindedness and natural right and see if he can put them together. And that putting those together will give him the answer. How does one determine whether changes in constitutive meaning are authentic or unauthentic? The original notion of natural right, another thing that I want to say about this, that in Latin it's the same expression. Jus naturale means both natural right, can be translated as natural right and natural law. Jus, I-U-S. So the notion of natural right or natural law arose in rebuttal to the proposal by some ancient Greeks, a proposal that sounds almost postmodern, that underpinning human manners and customs, there is no permanent and binding force. The notion of natural right means that underneath the manifold of human lifestyles, there is a component or factor that possesses the claims to universality and the permanence of nature itself. Now notice it's right here that Lonergan gives his reference to Strauss's book, Natural Right in History. The problem, though, and I think it's clear that Lonergan sees that Strauss is going one way and he wants to go another way on this. The problem is that this component that possesses a claim to universality and permanence admits two interpretations. It may be placed in universal propositions, self-evident truths, naturally known certitudes. And I think, although he doesn't say so, that he thinks this is what Strauss was doing. Or it may be placed in nature itself as concretely operating. Not as abstractly conceived and formulated, but as concretely operating. And here, I think it's very relevant that his reference is to Eric Voegelin's Reason, the Classic Experience, a paper that I find so close to Lonergan's cognitional theory that if you didn't know who the author is, you'd say, well, this might have been written by Lonergan. His, Voegelin's understanding of cognitional process as that's manifested in the classical Greek authors, Plato and Aristotle in particular. Reason, the classic experience. Nature as it concretely operates, which of course is what Lonergan is concerned about. And that's the one that he follows. It is, I believe, the second alternative, not the first, that has to be envisaged if we are to determine norms in historicity. So what is nature as concretely operating? Well, for Aristotle, a nature is an immanent principle of movement and of rest. And for Lonergan, well, we find that in the human spirit, raising and answering questions. As raising questions, it's an immanent principle of movement. As answering questions and doing so satisfactorily, it's an immanent principle of rest. So, we've got something here that meets Aristotle's definition of nature concretely operating, the human spirit raising and answering questions. So he goes through his familiar presentation. There are questions for intelligence, and then there are questions for reflection, and then there are questions for deliberation. But then he raises a problem. Well, then, how many natures are we talking about? We've got questions for intelligence, satisfied by insights, questions for reflection, satisfied by good judgments, questions for deliberation, satisfied by good decisions. Are we talking about three different natures? Well, the many form a series, each in turn taking over where its predecessor left off. So insight, then reflection and judgment, and then deliberation and decision. It's a series. And in that sense, there's some unity. But even more, if what the several principles attain are only aspects of something richer and fuller, must not the several principles themselves be but aspects of a deeper and more comprehensive principle? And is not that deeper and more comprehensive principle itself a nature? At once a principle of movement and of rest. And here we come to what I think is a very significant formulation. A tidal movement that begins before consciousness unfolds through sensitivity, intelligence, rational reflection, responsible deliberation, only to find its rest beyond all of these. And where it finds its rest, as you'll say in a moment, is being in love. So there's an underlying dynamism in the human person that is headed through intelligence, reflection, and deliberation to that point beyond that is being in love, a dynamic state that sublates all that goes before, a principle of movement at once purgative and illuminative, and a principle of rest in which union is fulfilled, and so that is grace. So here's this whole notion of vertical finality heading towards what it can't reach of its own accord, but in obediential potency to the gift of grace, which will give it the rest that it has been seeking in all of its striving. Language such as tidal movement, reference to its beginning before consciousness and unfolding through the four levels, an overarching intentional consciousness in love calls to mind the affective dimensions of the person that Lonergan became so concerned with in his late writing, that have their roots in the vertical finality of underlying neural manifolds. And so it relates very easily, I think, to the whole talk of psychic conversion, which is the kind of thing that I'm trying to get at by speaking in that way. So the whole movement is an ongoing process of self-transcendence. And that's shown at each level. He goes through that. Experience, understanding, judgment, decision. And self-transcendence reaches its term not in righteousness, but in love. And when we fall in love, then life begins anew. A new principle takes over, and as long as it lasts, we're lifted above ourselves and carried along as parts within an ever more intimate and ever more liberating dynamic whole. So it's in that ongoing process of self-transcendence, and in that alone, that we could find what would determine norms in historicity. It's in the ongoing process of self-transcendence. All right, now we're going to go into the dialectic of history in section 3, and I think we should leave that for next week. We've only got about 5 minutes left, and there's no way we can get through. It's a very complex. Do you mind leaving it and just stopping at this point, and we'll pick up next week there, but we can take questions on what he's done up to this point. Because what he moves then, what he does in the rest of it, is to take this whole thing and to show how it gets played out on the stage of human history through the various plateaus of human development and so on through human history. And it's a very complicated thing. It complicates the structure. So what I'd rather do is to stop where we are and to take any comments or questions that you might have about the paper up to this point. Yes, Joseph?
I think the problem we are facing today is a problem of a peculiar understanding of human nature. Whether there is a static form of nature peculiar to everybody who is human, or whether human nature is dynamic in the sense of not being the same for everybody. And the sense I'm getting from Lonergan is the transcendental methods, for instance, let me still use that word then, because that's the word that came to my mind now, appears to be the human, specific human nature. How different or how similar is that to the other notion of human nature, which science, for instance, appears to have, that human nature is almost like that of other animals in the sense of being determined. How different is these two concepts of human nature? I don't know.
How different is the notion of nature expressed in the transcendental method from a scientific notion that would reduce, sure. Very different.
Yeah, sure.
But the difference would come in the issue of the analysis of insight, judgment, and moral decision. And then the question, is there any evidence that animals could have written Hamlet? Or could have discovered the theory of relativity, or can make reasonable judgments in the world mediated by meaning. The animal will come to a conclusion of how best to get the banana, or whatever, you know. I mean, you can see rudimentary kinds of things.
Yeah.
I remember once watching two puppies, one of whom was about 3 months older than the other one, and they were fighting over a ball.
Yeah.
And the other one finally took the ball in her mouth, and the older one jumped up on the couch and put it at the back of the couch, where in a sense she knew that the little one would not be able to, he couldn't jump up on the couch. Mm-hmm. And she walked away with a sense of great satisfaction. there's something that is akin to insight there, all right? And then the other one's, you know, he can't get up there. He's too little, you know. So, but you know, it, It's those kinds of issues, you know. I mean, there is a statistical possibility that a monkey sitting at a typewriter could write a poem, but, you know, not because that's what he set out to do, you know. So there's there's issues like that, you know, are the questions, I think, and then making moral decisions and so on. It's in the area of interiority that, you know, I mean, behaviorist psychology will reduce everything to stimulus response. When I started studying psychology, it was my first major that I switched to philosophy, but I think the reason was that they weren't dealing with meaning, you know, and philosophy was dealing with meaning. But the psychology, then, this was at St. Louis University, it was all behaviorism. I wasn't interested in that, you know. But there's that little black box of our interiority, you know, that they just don't enter into. That's where the difference will come.
I was reading somewhere in the readings this week that a humanist would agree with the whole notion of self-transcendence, but not with any idea of God or a greater power. So I was thinking of Daniel Helminek's paper.
Mm-hmm.
That would that be along the same lines? That
the one that he gave here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how could you talk about healing and progress?
Yeah, I don't think, there's two things. I don't think Dan holds that there is no God. I don't think he's an atheist.
No.
At all. I think what he's trying to do is to present a notion of spirituality that is generic enough that it can be communicated to people who are outside of any religious tradition.
So he wouldn't be a humanist?
Not in that sense, no. But I think he feels very much at home with humanists in that sense and wants to talk to them. But I don't think... I don't agree with everything he said in his paper.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that what he's presenting is... I know that he's sometimes understood that way, but I think I know him well enough over the years to know that that's not the case personally. That, you know. But he's trying to develop a generic notion of spirituality based in Lonergan, so that be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. And it certainly is communicating something that is eminently worthwhile. Nor is he militantly arguing against religion. He's not in any way at all. He's just not talking about it. And then we have to admit, you know, we all have to admit the extent to which there is inauthentic religion, you know, is something that is to be...
Mm-hmm.
And religion as a source of violence that's becoming so clear in our contemporary world. You know, and not just in Islam, but the implication of Christianity and violence through the centuries. The Crusades, the Inquisition, and so on. Sacrificing victims, human sacrifice. Burning people at the stake, human sacrifice. You know, Abraham knew that God didn't want human sacrifice, but the church did it down into the 16th and 17th century. And we can't deny that. So anyway, all of those things.
So I was just thinking, a humanist, though, couldn't explain healing and progress.
Well, progress, yes, because progress is the result of being attentive, intelligent, and responsible. So,
right.
And the decline is the result of refusing to be
self-correcting
attentive.
Process.
Yeah. But what the humanist can't explain is any kind of recovery from decline.
Yeah.
When, in fact, the only recovery is self-sacrificing love and charity and so on. It's in the stupid. Well, they can explain it, but they don't reach to the fact that this is in the order of grace. You know, we do this. We don't do this naturally.
Yeah.
We just don't do it naturally. And it's Martin Luther King, you know, who did it. But he knew that he was doing it in the order of grace. And I was so impressed the first time I listened to that man on television and the language of redemptive suffering. But he learned that right out of the gospel. That didn't come from anywhere else. And so what he was catalyzing in his people was the movement beyond what we've been dealing with, the racism and violence and so on, is the law of the cross. Mm-hmm. Nothing else. You know. Okay. Now, Dan doesn't get into that, and he denied in his paper a fifth level, and I really disagree with that. There's a fifth level of consciousness which is not intentional. It is a gift. It's received. And it's the consolation without a cause. And then, you know, then intentionality takes over. But we receive from God. God's love. Mediated by others. Okay. So we'll pick up the rest of it next, the rest of this one next week. And we'll move on to theology and praxis. And I scheduled the thing on the questionnaire on philosophy, but I don't know whether we'll get into that next week. We'll see.
Thank you.
Thank you.